Good morning, or whatever time of day it is. As advertised, this series will be focusing on one of the lesser known and less investigated aspect of the career of Maimonides. Usually, when somebody talks about Maimonides, or Rambam, as the case may be. In fact, tell you an interesting distinction. I would say that when people talk about Maimonides, they tend to be talking primarily about his philosophical works. When they talk about Rambam, they tend to be talking primarily about his halachic works. And what we're going to look at, it has elements of both his halachic stature and his philosophical acumen, but they are not per se either halachic or philosophical. They fall under a different rubric, which I'll basically be talking about today before we get into the actual texts themselves. So I named this series Rambam, A Man of Letters, as kind of a double entendre. Surely he was a man of letters in the sense of being well-read, well-educated, articulate. But the double entendre is that the focus will be on his epistolary works, right? The word epistle being kind of fancy word for a letter, but it's more than just a letter that starts off, "Dear so-and-so," and is signed off, "Sincerely yours." It's more in the sense of a monograph. So we'll be looking primarily at three of Rambam's monographs, and we'll try to place each of them into its distinctive historical and cultural context. Now, since the first of the three is his Igeret, again, a monograph or epistle, Igeret Hashmad, a monograph that he wrote on the subject of persecution or forced conversion, we'll be spending a good deal of time simply understanding the historical and cultural context in which Rambam as an individual, the family of Maimonides, is a larger sense, and going out from there in concentric circles, the Jewish community of Egypt, and beyond that, the Jewish communities of the Muslim world, to talk a little bit about their historical and cultural and social circumstances. And that will give us a background that will serve us well when we look at the three chosen Igrot, of which the Igeret Hashmad, the monograph on the subject of forced conversion and persecution, is the first. Igeret Teman, literally the letter to Yemen, which focuses on false messianism, will be the second. And the third and final one is called the Igeret Tchiyat HaMetim, literally the monograph on the subject of resurrection, which comes as close as we're going to come to an actually philosophical subject. So let me open the PowerPoint and we'll get started with that. Okay. So as you see, the subject for this morning is preliminary. That's why it isn't one of the three letters that I mentioned just a moment ago. It's not the Igeret Hashmad, it's not the Igeret Teman, it's not the Igeret Tchiyat HaMetim, it's none of those three. In fact, it wasn't even written by Rambam. Our subject today, our focus today, will be on something called the Igeret HaNechama, the letter or a monograph on the subject of consolation. And its author was Maimon. Obviously, Rambam is called Maimonides because he was the son of someone named Maimon. So Maimon, the author of this letter on the subject of consolation, was none other than Rambam's father. Okay. And we will see when we get to Rambam's own letter on the subject, how it relates to his father's work. But before we get to any of that, as I said, let's take a step all the way back to the 7th century. And let's just touch on some of the highlights of the history of Jews as individuals and Jewish communities as social and political entities within the Muslim world. And that, of course, begins in the 7th century of the Common Era, because prior to the 7th century, there was no Muslim world. So Islam began in the 7th century in the Arabian Peninsula, and it was begun by an individual by the name of Muhammad, son of Abdullah, who was a resident of the city of Mecca, an important city on the caravan routes that crisscrossed Arabia in those days, and that were used by merchants and by traders in order to bring things that would come into the Arabian Peninsula from the Indian Ocean to its south and carry them overland to what we know from earlier historical periods as the Fertile Crescent, to what was once known as Mesopotamia, into what we know as the land of Israel, and to North Africa. So in that respect, Arabia was a very important transition point for all of these trades. And this Muhammad ibn Abdallah was one, a very successful trader, someone who plied these trade routes. And during his travels through Arabia and beyond, he came into contact with Christians and with Jews, and was influenced by them to become a monotheist. That is to say that the religion in Arabia, the primary religion in Arabia prior to the 7th century, was paganism or polytheism. Muhammad was inspired by his contacts with Jews and Christians to begin to preach monotheism to the pagan Arabs in Mecca. Now, initially, it was too much for them, and they rejected both his ideas and they rejected him personally. And they made life very difficult for him, and he was forced to flee from his home in Mecca to the reasonably nearby city of Medina. There in Medina, he was more successful. He succeeded in gathering people who accepted his ideas and his preaching. And eventually he was able to return to Mecca, no longer as a radical individual preaching a revolutionary idea, but he was able to return to Mecca essentially as the head of a new religious and social movement. In fact, this return of Muhammad from Medina to Mecca in the year 622, which is known by the Arabic word of Hijra, which is related to the Hebrew verb Hey Gimel Resh, which in modern Hebrew means to emigrate. Okay, this event, his triumphant, as it were, return from Medina to Mecca, marks the beginning of the Muslim era. The Muslim calendar, as it were, counts the year 622 as year one. Now, the God whom Muhammad wanted the Arabs to worship was called Allah, which is the Arabic equivalent of the Hebrew word El, okay, simply meaning a deity. Okay, and the religion that he was promoting was called Islam. The word itself means to yield or to submit. Therefore, one who yields or submits to the will of the God known as Allah is called a Muslim. Arabic for one who has yielded or submitted. How do you know what the will of Allah is? The will of Allah came to be recognized through the prophecies of Muhammad, which were recorded in the scriptures of Islam that are known as the Quran, which is cognate with the Hebrew word Mikra, which, as those of you who've been through some of my Bible classes may recall, doesn't mean to read in the sense of sight reading, which is the way we understand it, but it really means to recite, that is to say, to verbalize, to articulate. And both in Islam as in Judaism, scriptures were not meant so much to be sight read as they were meant to be recited. To give you some idea, this on the screen in front of you is a description of the opening chapter of the Quran, and it is considered to be pretty much the quintessence of Islam. The Arabic words on the very top read Surat al-Fatiha. Surah is the Arabic word for a chapter. Fatiha sounds like the Hebrew word liftoach, and indeed, it's the opening chapter. The second line in Arabic actually repeats itself at the beginning of every chapter of the Quran, and it consists of the words Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. In the name is Shem, the name of Allah, the Rahman, and the Rahim. Ha-Rahaman or Ha-Mirrahim, that is to say, the compassionate or the merciful. Those are the not the only, but they are the leading epithets of Allah. And you can get a sense that the fact that they referred to their deity as the merciful and the compassionate, as the Rahaman, is again under the influence of both Judaism and Christianity. Other than the opening chapter, which is essentially like the recitation of a creed or a dogma, and we'll see it in the next slide, the balance of the Quran, interestingly enough, is arranged not in the chronological order in which the prophecies are believed to have been revealed, but it's kind of a much more practical organization. Chapter 2 of the Quran is the longest chapter, and the final chapter of the Quran is the shortest chapter. So since it's arranged not in the sequence in which it was revealed, but only in the size order, generally in well-edited editions of the Quran, every chapter is identified as belonging either to the time in which Muhammad worked in Mecca, which was the earlier period in his career, or as belonging to the time that Muhammad spent in Medina, which would be the second stage, so to speak, of his career. Here is the actual text of the the opening chapter of the Quran. As you can see, it consists of only seven verses, of which the first is, as we've already pointed out, simply the announcement in the name of Allah, the most gracious, the most merciful. And just to get a sense again of what some of the principal beliefs of Islam are, because what we're going to do is see if we can recognize in them where they might have been influenced by Jewish beliefs and practices. So I chose a text that also provides the Arabic in transliteration, because we can get at least a flavor of how much the words or the sounds of the Quran resonate with words and sounds that we recognize from the Jewish tradition. So if we begin in verse 2, it says, praise to Allah, the one who cherishes and sustains the two worlds. Notice in Arabic, it's called Rab. That's like the Hebrew word Rav in the sense of master. Okay. Al-Alamin. You may hear in the word Alamin the Hebrew word Olam, except that in Arabic, Alamin is a dual. So it means not worlds in multiple, it means specifically two worlds. And we know indeed just what the two worlds are because we know them from the Jewish tradition. They are what we call Olam Hazeh and Olam Haba. So the Quran basically opens with an acknowledgement that God is powerful, that God is omnipotent in both worlds, not only in the physical, tangible, concrete world in which we live, but also in what we might call the metaphysical world or the spiritual world that's all about us. And then it continues in verse 3, and it calls him the most gracious and most merciful. We've already taken note of that, Ar-Rahmani, Ar-Rahim. But notice in verse 4, yet another epithet of Allah. He's called the master of the day of judgment. Now, if you take a look at the Arabic transliteration of the Arabic, it's something that anybody who knows Hebrew can read. Because the word Malik is the word for king. Yaum is the word for day. And judgment is din. So Malik, Yaum Adin, is the king, the master of the day of judgment. So we can see again that Muhammad took very seriously the idea that we all are destined to come before God in judgment. Verse 5, addressing God, we worship you, we seek your aid. We ask you in verse 6 to show us the straight way. And the straight way is modified in verse 7 as the way of those on whom God has bestowed his grace, the way of those who do not incur God's anger, that is to say, the straight path, not the path of those who might go astray. So because this is kind of like encapsulates some of the basic theology of Islam, as I said, it was placed at the beginning of the Quran, despite its size, right? And it is called the not only the opening chapter of the Quran, but as I suggested, it is regarded as kind of like a testimony of faith, right? Kind of, if you'll pardon the analogy, it's kind of like the first chapter of Shema, right? It's a declaration of our recognition of the unity of God. It's our acknowledgement that our belief in God isn't only something intellectual, but it obligates us in certain rites, in certain rituals, in certain performances. So in that regard, this is pretty much its Muslim equivalent. And indeed, there are numerous Jewish elements in the Islamic religion, both in its theology as well as in its practice. In the Quran itself, Abraham and Moses are given honorable mention, as are Joseph and David and Solomon and other biblical figures. Many Jewish concepts and ideas found their way into Islam, including some that are considered to be amongst the pillars of Islam. It's bedrock principles, such as prayer, which in Arabic is called Salat. And in this case, it's not so much an echo of a Hebrew word as it is an echo of an Aramaic word. The Arabic word Salat is the cognate of the Aramaic word Tzilosa, okay? Fasting, which both in Hebrew and in Arabic is called Tzom. Charity, which in Arabic is called Zakat. It's kind of like the Hebrew word zechut, to acquire merit. Pilgrimage, Hajj, which is cognate to the Hebrew word chag. Okay. And again, as we've already taken notice, the recognition of a day of judgment, the Yom HaDin. In my estimation, and it's not mine alone, and it isn't even originally mine, the Jewish practice that had the single greatest impact on Mohammed was Yom HaKippurim. What evidence is there of that? First of all, there's evidence that before the Muslims adopted the month-long fast of Ramadan, right, which was just about a month ago, okay, before they adopted the month-long fast of Ramadan, Muslims observed an annual fast day, which, curiously enough, is called Ashura. Ashura, Ashara, is the Arabic equivalent of the Hebrew numeral for 10, Asara. And it is clearly an allusion to the date of Yom HaKippurim, which is the 10th day of the month of Tishrei. It's also arguable that the Muslim custom of praying 5 times a day may also have been patterned after Yom HaKippurim, because Yom HaKippurim is the only day in the Jewish year in which we have 5 formal prayer services, because of even on Shabbat and in Yamim Tovim, when we have the additional Musaf service, it comes to only 4. On Yom HaKippurim, there's the additional service that was observed on public fast days, Ne'ilah, and that raises the number of prayer services on Yom HaKippurim to 5. There's also the fact that when Muslims go on their pilgrimage to Mecca, they traditionally wear a white robe that also may have been taken from the practices of Yom HaKippurim, on which it is traditional to wear a white robe, what we at least Eastern European Jews call a kittel. Perhaps even the centrality of Jerusalem can be recognized in early Islam, that is, before the direction of prayer was turned to the city of Mecca and to the Kaaba shrine in Mecca, Muslims face Jerusalem in prayer. The notation on the bottom is simply a couple of references. If you're interested, Abraham Katz wrote a book called Judaism in Islam, which is a study of Jewish, both biblical and Talmudic Agadic material, mostly, but not exclusively, in chapter 2, the longest chapter of the Quran, which is called the chapter of the cow, a reference to the Parah Aduma. That kind of makes it a little timely because it was last week's Parshat HaShavua. And there's also a study by the Bible scholar James Kugel called In Potiphar's House that, among other things, contains an analysis of the Joseph chapter of the Quran. So these are simply recommendations for further reading. Now, up until now, we've seen a little bit about the relationship between two abstractions, the Jewish religion as an abstraction and Islam as an abstraction. Now we're going to narrow our focus a little and to see a little bit about what was the relationship between Jews as real living flesh and blood individuals or communities made up of Jews and Islam, again, as individual Muslims and as a nation made up of those individuals. So this section is entitled with an Arabic word, dhimma, right, which means someone who is tolerated. And it addresses the question of what was the legal status of Jews under Islam. So by the 8th century, that is to say, roughly within 100 years of the founding of Islam by Mohammed. Mohammed, for example, died in the year 632. Okay, so by the year 750, roughly 100 years later, the Muslims had succeeded in conquering Arabia, Palestine, Syria, right, Mesopotamia, right, which in those days was the seat of the Persian Empire, and North Africa. Right? Shortly thereafter, right, Muslim forces would cross from North Africa into the European continent over the Straits of Gibraltar and conquer Spain. In fact, Gibraltar is actually an anglicization of two Arabic words. The original and the name, the Arabic name of Gibraltar is Jebel Tariq. Jebel is Arabic for a mountain. Tariq was the name of the Muslim commander who led the armies across into Europe. So in honor of his crossing, those straits were named for him. They were called Tariq's Mountain. And from Jebel Tariq, we get Gibraltar. Now, these conquests, right, particularly the conquest of Persia, right, Persia being what was once Babylonia, right, Mesopotamia, brought under Islamic control, under Islamic rule, not only the majority of what were then the world's Jewish population, but particularly what were the traditional centers of Jewish life, of Jewish religious and spiritual life, both in the land of Israel and in Babylonia. Generally, Muslims imposed their religion on the people they conquered, often at the pain of death. However, because of the spiritual kinship they felt to Jews and Christians, they made exceptions for them. These exceptions gave Jews and Christians religious tolerance, that's the term dhimma, in exchange for the Jews and Christians accepting Muslim sovereignty and paying a special head tax, poll tax. Okay. Now, why did Jews and Christians, why were they given this special recognition? And as the parenthesis says at the bottom, why later on was this extended even to Zoroastrians? Okay. When Zoroastrians, unlike Jews and Christians, are not monotheists, Zoroastrians are dualists, right? Their pantheon consists of two gods. Okay. The answer is because Jews and Christians and later Zoroastrians were considered the people of the book. Now, I know this may come as a disappointment to some of you. I know that a lot of people think that Jews are called the people of the book because we read a lot. Okay. That may be true, but historically, the origin of the phrase people of the book is in the way that Jews and Christians were designated by Muslims, because the designation was based on the fact that Jews and Christians had a revealed scripture, that they conducted their lives as individuals and as communities on the basis of these revealed scriptures. Hence, the Torah, right, and the Gospels are recognized by the Quran, not recognized as being adequate or useful for Muslims, but they are recognized as being minimally adequate, at least for the purposes of Jews and Christians. And that is why Jews and Christians were given religious freedom under Islam, while pagans were invariably forced to accept the Islamic religion. And with that in mind, we can now approach Rambam and take a look briefly at some of Rambam's views on the relationship between Judaism and Islam, or the relationship between Jews and Muslims. Rambam was born in Spain. He was born either in 1135 or 1138. There is still no unanimity amongst historians as to whether he was born in the prior year or the subsequent year. Part of it may just be due to the fact that a 5 in Hebrew is a hey, and an 8 in Hebrew is a chet, and very, very often the letters hey and chet just simply cannot be distinguished one from another. Okay. His father, Maimon, we've already mentioned that, Okay, that's why he was called Maimonides, that would be the son of Maimon, was a dayan, a judge, in the Spanish city of Cordoba. At the approximate age of 13, which would be either in 1148 or in 1151, the family of Maimon, along with many Spanish Jews, fled Spain to North Africa in order to escape persecution by a fanatical Muslim sect called the Almohads. We'll speak about them in a little greater detail in just a moment. They spent several years in Fez in Morocco, and from Morocco they relocated to Egypt, to Fustat, old Cairo, where Maimonides practiced medicine while composing his many philosophical and halachic works. About his death, we are more certain than we are about his birth. He died in December of the year 1204. And while I have really no idea what the origin is or what authenticity, if any, we can give to the traditional portrait of Maimonides that you see, I can tell you that the signature on the bottom is authentic, because we have found it on numerous Geniza documents. So indeed, Moshe Rabbi Maimon, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, Moses, the son of Maimon, right? That indeed was his signature. Now, I mentioned at the very, very beginning that there's a tendency to examine Maimonides either entirely as a philosopher, or entirely as a halachic authority, or maybe to synthesize the two and to speak of Maimonides as this individual who was both a great philosopher and also an outstanding halachic authority. And of course, we also know that he was a medical man, right? A doctor, okay? What those observations, however, tend to overlook is that Maimonides also was filled a very important communal role in his lifetime. He was, and in this position, he was succeeded by several generations of his descendants. He actually held an official position in the Jewish community of Egypt. The title by which he and his descendants were known is Nagid, a Hebrew word, Nun Gimel Yod Dalid Nagid, which basically means one who leads, one who directs. And therefore, as I said, there was this whole other facet to Rambam's activities and to Rambam's personality, which reflects not so much his individual personal accomplishments as a philosopher, as a halachist, as a scientist, but which are reflective of his accomplishments as a communal official on behalf, first and foremost, of his local community, the community of Jews in Cairo, the community of Jews in Egypt, but even going beyond that, to his influence on affairs and events that touched upon the lives of Jewish communities elsewhere in the world. And that will be the subject of primarily of the Igeret Teiman, the letter to Yemen, which we will get to in due time. So here, for example, we have an example of a responsa. Maimonides did not only compose a code of Jewish law, the Mishneh Torah, but Maimonides also responded, as you can see, to hundreds of questions on religious affairs. Here, for example, you can see, here is a responsum numbered 448. That means at the very least, there are 447 other responsa that Maimonides wrote. This is a rather interesting responsum, particularly on account of the person to whom it was addressed. As you see, it was addressed to Ovadia Hager, Ovadia the proselyte. There is a good deal of scholarly literature on just who this Ovadia was. There's some speculation that he was not just any convert to Judaism, that he was a Christian convert to Judaism, and that he was prior to his conversion, that he was a nobleman, a Christian nobleman. And he was in correspondence with Maimonides. Perhaps the best known aspect of their halachic correspondence was when he wrote to Maimonides to ask whether it's okay for him in his recitation of the opening passage in the Shmoneh Esrei to talk about the God of his ancestors, right? Because after all, as a convert, right, his ancestors didn't worship the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So he wrote to Maimonides asking, does it compromise his intellectual integrity, so to speak, if he speaks of the God of Israel as the God of his ancestors? And Maimonides wrote back saying, no, that someone who converts to Judaism, it is as though he was a descendant of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and therefore there is no compromise here of integrity whatsoever. So this is the same Ovadia HaGer. Here, he asked Maimonides a different question. His question was, what should his attitude be towards Islam? And we see the text of the question. We don't know whether this was the full text of the question or this is Maimonides' synopsis of the question. But the question is as follows. Namely, you maintain, right, that is to say, the one who wrote the letter, okay, maintains that Ishmaelites, Yishmaelim, that's the way in which Muslims or even Arabs in general are referred to in rabbinic literature, okay, are not idolaters, okay? Meaning that's what Ovadia HaGer was inclined to believe on his own. However, his teacher told him that they are idolaters. And what was his proof that Islam is idolatry? That one of the rituals observed by Muslims when they go on pilgrimage to Mecca is they throw stones. Now, the Talmud, in a tractate that not surprisingly is called Avodah Zarah, idolatry, describes such a practice, the practice of throwing stones, and it's called Hazorek Even LeMarkolis. Marcolis is the Talmudic name of the god Mercury. And apparently, one aspect of the worship, of the pagan worship of Mercury, consisted of throwing stones. Therefore, just as throwing stones to Mercury is clearly an idolatrous practice, this respondent's teacher argued that since Muslims throw stones, that must be an idolatrous practice also. Let's see Rambam's response. Hatshuva. Elu hayishma'elim enam ovedei avodah zarah klal. Categorical statement. Maimonides says, Ishmaelites are not idolaters at all. He even goes further. And he says, "Uchvar nichrita mipihem umilibam," that any idolatrous practices, or for that matter, even idolatrous thoughts, have already been removed from them. On the contrary, he says, "Hem miyachadim la'el yitale yichud karaoi." They recognize the unity of God properly. Yichud she'en bo dofi, meaning the God whom they call Allah is one and the same with the God worshipped by the Jews. Therefore, their worship of Allah is truly the worship of a unitary and unified God. And he continues in some detail. He says that if one were to, even if one were to maintain that the Kaaba in Mecca, that is to say, that structure, okay, that Muslims go to during their pilgrimage, houses an idol that was worshipped by their ancestors, which is not actually the case. All there is in the Kaaba is a black stone, a meteor. But in the pre-Islamic era, it was indeed that idols were housed there. Okay, so Maimonides says that even if one makes the argument that the Kaaba, right, that structure that is central to Islam, was in fact a house of idolatry, he says that doesn't matter if those who bow to it today are not bowing to it for an idolatrous purpose, but they bow to it for a legitimate purpose. Indeed, he says that the Talmud in the Tractate of Sanhedrin says that if somebody bowed towards a temple of idolatry, mistaking it for a synagogue, Hare libo masur l'ashamayim, then it's his intention that counts, not the facts on the ground. Similarly, he concludes and he says that these Ishmaelites today, including women and children, are, he says, free of idolatry. He doesn't say that they are paragons of religious virtue. He says that they have other mistakes, right? Ta'utam v'tipshutam bidvarim acherim hi, right? That they have other mistakes, they make other errors, but they are not in this matter of theology. But he says he can't really discuss those things in writing, that is to say in public. Why? Mipnei poshei v'rishei Yisrael. It's an important thing to take note of. Apparently, there were Jews who, in order to curry favor with the Muslim government, tattle the tale, as it were, on Jews who were critical of Islam. Therefore, Maimonides here, in a somewhat oblique fashion, says that there is what to criticize, but he's too conservative, as it were, to actually discuss them openly. And it isn't only in that responsum that we see this reflection of his view on Islam. It shows up in his Code of Jewish Law in the Mishneh Torah as well, in a section called Hilchot Ma'achalot Asurot, laws that pertain to foods that are forbidden to Jews. And in it, Maimonides says that a genuine convert, or at least somebody who has abandoned idolatry, a ger toshav, the words literally mean a resident alien, and he defines it, someone who has accepted the 7 Noahide commandments. Okay, so he's not a full Jew. He hasn't undergone circumcision or immersion in a mikvah in order to become totally Jewish. But by accepting the 7 Noahide commandments, he has at least given an indication of abandoning idolatry. Okay, because he's not fully Jewish, yeno asur bishtia, right? You cannot drink wine that he produces. That is as though he were a pagan. However, unlike pagan wine, which one may not drink nor benefit from, the wine that belongs to someone who has abandoned idolatry, mutar bahanaya, it's permissible to derive benefit from it. Which means, I suppose, that if you had you were a merchant, you could sell it, right? And you could make a profit on it. Similarly, miachadin etzlo yayin ve'en mafkidin etzlo yayin. His status is such that you can leave wine with him briefly without fear that he'll tamper with it, but you don't leave wine with him for an extended period of time. Likewise, he says, any Gentile who is not idolatrous, right, such as the Yishmaelites, kigon elu ha-Yishmaelim, they fall into the same category. Yeno asur bishtiyah, it's prohibited to drink wine that they manufacture. however, mutar bahanaya, it is, however, permissible to get benefit from it. And he says that this is not just his personal opinion. He says, v'chein horu kol ha-ge'onim, this is, in fact, the unanimous opinion of his predecessors, the Ge'onim. And here now we come to the turning point, not only in the history of Maimonides personally, but actually in the history of Jews in the Muslim world. I mentioned previously that when Maimonides was about 13 years old, which would make it either in 1148 or 1151, his family, like many Jews, were forced to into exile from Spain because of persecution on the part of a fanatical Muslim sect called the Almohads. If you look in the middle of the text in front of you, there's an explanation of what the word Almohad means. In Arabic, Almohad is Al-Muwahadun. If you know how to count in Arabic, you know that the Arabic numeral one is Wahad. And there's clearly a relationship between the numeral one and the name of this sect, Al-Muwahadun. And that is that they were called the Muwahadun, if you wish, the Oneers, because they were obsessed with God's unity. In fact, from their perspective, not only were Jews and Christians infidels, but they considered most other Muslims to be insufficiently religious. And therefore, not only did they persecute Jews and Christians, but they also persecuted other Muslims. Difference, however, is that in persecuting other Muslims, they wanted them to be more stringent in their religious or philosophical beliefs, but they weren't calling upon them to convert. But when they addressed Jews and Christians, they wanted them to convert to Islam, and they made it clear that if they didn't convert voluntarily, right, that they would be coerced into conversion, and that the only option into forcible conversion was simply to be martyred, to surrender their lives. Now, when this sect came to power in Morocco in 1146, the government gave Jews and Christians an ultimatum of either conversion or death. The king believed in the existence of a Jewish tradition that the Jewish Messiah would redeem the Jews 500 years after the revelation of Muhammad, which we know, because that was our opening, began in the year 622. In 1146, it was already more than 500 years later. Therefore, he concluded that the Messiah was not going to come, and therefore he took this as a sign that the Jews should convert to Islam. The Jewish community pleaded with the government to be spared from the decree, which to Jews was called Gezerah Tashmad, Gezerah, a decree, Shmad, persecution or forcible conversion. And they arrived initially at a compromise. The compromise was that if the Jews did not want to convert, they could leave the country. 2 years later, in 1148, after the Almohads rose to power in Morocco, they conquered Spain. They subsequently imposed this same edict on the Jews of Spain. Hence, entire Jewish communities, well-known communities, Cordoba, where Maimonides was born, Granada, etc., were essentially emptied of their Jews. As in Morocco, Jews were forced to flee the country or convert to Islam. Maimonides then was 13 years old. His family fled from Spain to Morocco, where they lived for several years. And finally, they moved from Morocco to Egypt, as we mentioned. And it was there in Egypt that Maimonides wrote most of the compositions for which he has become so famous that, as you probably know, they coined the proverb, Mi Moshe va'ad Moshe lo kam kemoshe, that from Moshe Rabbeinu, from biblical Moses, until Moses Maimonides, there was none like either of them. The last thing that I want to show you this morning is that in 1160, recognizing the low morale of Spanish Jewry on account of these persecutions and forcible exiles, not Rambam, but Maimon, his father, wrote a letter to the Jewish community of Spain called Igeret HaNechama, the letter of consolation. In the letter, he urged Jews to continue praying to God three times a day, despite the difficulty and dangers involved. And it was perhaps this sense of leadership and responsibility and love for the Jewish people that was exhibited in this letter that was passed from Maimon to his son. This is just the front piece of one of many editions of the Igeret HaNechama. As you can see, this one was published in Warsaw in 1912. Okay. And this is just a couple of selections from. In fact, we'll just look at this one. This is actually the introduction to it. It's called Igeret Mimorenu V'Rabenu Maimon Ben Rabenu Morenu V'Rabenu Yehosef Zecher Tzadik Livracha. So it identifies the author of this Igeret HaNechama, of this letter of consolation, as being a Rabbi Maimon, son of a Rabbi Yosef, right? Be'ir Fez, that's the highlighted portion, right? In the city of Fez in Morocco. Now here's a curious one. Bishnat, in what year was it written? Aleph Tav Nun Yud Yud Aleph Lishtarot. Now that's another curiosity, okay? This is not a year to creation of the world. It's not a year to the so-called common era. It isn't even dated according to the Muslim era. It's dated according to an era that is called Minyan Hashtarot. Minyan Hashtarot is known to historians as the Seleucid era because it began in the year 311 BCE, right? Began in the year 311 BCE. And it began pretty much at the same time that the, remember, Alexander the Great conquered the Middle East maybe 20 years earlier. So the Seleucid era, it pretty much recognizes the beginning of Greco-Roman influence in the Middle East. So Aleph is 1,000, Tav is 400, Nun is 50, Yud is 10, another Yud is another 10, and Aleph is 1. So if you add it all up, it comes to 1,471. Now remember, the Seleucid era began in the year 311 before the Common Era. So subtract 311 from 1,471, and that's how you know that this letter of consolation was written by Maimon, the father of Maimonides, in the year, anybody do the math? 1160. Okay. It's on this background that we will next week look at some excerpts from the follow-up letter, not the Igeret HaNechama, the letter of consolation of Maimon, but the Igeret HaShmad, the letter that addressed matters that pertain directly to forcible conversion that was written by his son Moses. I take a quick look at the chat and see, I can hear it. Okay. Okay. Right. Sorry. Okay. Anybody remember what this is? The international sign for pill pull, right? Muslims don't drink grape wine, but there are those who will drink raisin wine. So it's not particularly clear to me exactly what is being referred to. But yes, the Muslims, there are Muslims, and there always were Muslims who make wine and who drank wine. Why is it spelled Aleph Tav Nun Yud Yud Aleph? Because that actually approximates an Aramaic word. Itnia would be like Tanya, would be like it has been recorded or it has been reported. So where you can use gematria, where you can use alphanumerics in a way that it approximates a word, so that's just simply an established pattern or habit. Okay, that seems to be it. So next week, as I said, we will maybe, you know what, I'll think about it. Maybe we'll just look at one or two little excerpts from the letter of consolation that was written by Maimon, and then we'll go directly to the Igeret Hashmad, to the letter on the subject of persecution written by his son Moshe. Any other questions before we... Okay, Maya said she might not be here. Oh, I thought I was going to close, but you're here. So you can do the official closing.
Okay, thank you so much. That was amazing. So we've already been over the classes, all good. So we're just going to end this now. I will be ending this Zoom. And if you want to come on and join for Julie Mishkin's at 12, you're free to do that. But I'm going to end this one now, unless we have any closing comments. I think that was everything. Thanks, everyone.